content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we left off in the chapter Adulthood, which is for July and August, and our topic is Foliage, the Garden's Wardrobe. I frankly shop for leaves most of all, not flowers. So I bristle when I see charts of perennials or shrubs where they list just name, height, bloom time, and flower color. Why isn't there a column about the leaves? Flowers alone do not a garden make, since they represent the productive portion of the plant's life cycle, a mere moment in its year. Even in the commonest leaf color, green, the range of shades is infinite, from nearly chartreuse to olive, gray, and blue, with countless mid-green tones in between. Add to that the diversity of leaf size, shape, and texture, and you start to get the picture. Then take it one step further. To plants with variegated leaves, whether splashed or striped or edged in white, silver, or gold, pink, or red, and on to purple-leaved plants and gold ones, too. Many gardeners, especially beginners, are afraid of showy leaves, particularly unusually colored ones, because they aren't sure what goes with what. Green is the garden's neutral and seems safe, but too much plain old leaf green is pure monotony. One place I find inspiration for combining foliage colors is in plants themselves, particularly ones like Coleus and Ecalypha, the copper leaf plant, one of my favorite non-hardy choices for summer pots. Select a favorite one of either that combines two or more colors in its leaf, and make that your scheme. On a smaller scale, a container design time in spring, you will find me walking around the garden center holding one of these plants looking for good companions, both flowers and other foliage, that pick up on its palette. Designers Glenn Withy and Charles Price of Seattle, friends who rely heavily on colorful leaved plants, explain their strategy this way. To make colorful leaved plants work in a design, you have to have several incidents of their usual usage around the yard. Don't just go buy a purple-leaved or golden shrub and stick it alone somewhere. The recipe for an eyesore. Tie it into the larger picture by repeating the motive with an underplanting of coordinating purple-leaved perennials. Huchera, for instance, and the dark-leaved Simisifuga, Simplex Brunex. Brunette, now often labeled Actia simplex, or gold ones, like golden hostas, Acorus gramias, sweet flag, or grasses. Then, in the not-too-distant background, repeat the idea once more, with a small tree in the same general color. When viewing the garden, the eye will be drawn across the scene from one incident to the next. Instead of just focusing on the single out-of-place oddball. Colorful-leaved plants can play important tricks with perspective and light, too. Golden-leaved plants and white variegated ones advance, making dark corners or distant views pop. Dark-leaved shrubs tend to recede, giving a sense of distance, even in a tight space. They also make an exciting foil for flowers, or purple clematis draped over a golden-leaved shrub, or a bright-colored annual vine like canary creeper, over a purple smoke bush. Whatever color the foliage, a plant's leaves should also be evaluated for the ornamentality of their texture and shape. If you put ferns, a stilbe, and dwarf goat's beard next to one another, it would just read as a blur of ferny texture. But one of those near an astilboides tabularis with its large bold leaves and something linear or even spiky alongside that, Hakonechloa macra, for instance, would be a lot more interesting. Very large leaved plants are underutilized, probably because people are timid about anything so out of the ordinary scale-wise, just as they are of variegation or colored foliage. I cannot get enough of either. Plain old rhubarb has a prominent spot here, beautiful and delicious. Remember, if such subjects make you nervous, there are no mistakes in gardening, just experiments with a variety of outcomes, some more pleasing than others, but every one a critical bit of the gardener's education. And this next topic is squash madness. I do not know where my special affinity for pumpkins and squash began, for I am no great fan of trick-or-treat, but I admit being reduced each year to child age when I tap their giant seeds out of the packet or later on move among their giant leaves to giddily count the big fruits forming on the vine. At harvest time, I cannot wait to finally hug the offspring, to cradle a well-grown blue Hubbard in the crook of my arm, as if it were my own flesh, if somewhat thicker, sweeter, and more vividly colored. I never met a pumpkin I didn't like. The best have another endearing quality. They'll stick around on the kitchen counter until you're ready for them, rather than melt into a sloppy mess of spoiled fruit the way a tomato does. The so-called good keepers, thick-fleshed cheese pumpkins or butternut squash, will last all winter in storage. Versatile ingredients as a base for soup, a mashed vegetable, the stuff of pies or cakes, or even pureed and folded into biscuit batter. Good cooking is not the specialty of thin-walled, stringy jack-o'-lanterns whose flesh is watery and doesn't last. Though the genus Cucurbita is a bit of a tangle, not unlike a field of pumpkin vines, the ones we grow most commonly fit into four species. all natives of Central to South America. The summer squash, usually eaten immature before their skins harden, all fit into the popular species C. pepo. And if you want company for a day or week, grow a zucchini. Also in C. pepo are some popular winter squash like delicata, acorn, and sweet dumpling. Tiny pumpkins like Jack B. Little and white-skinned Little Boo, plus sugar pumpkins with the carving kind and the carving kind. The best keepers are generally in the species C. moschata, which also have the sweetest flesh, usually dark orange. This is where we find butternut, Canada crookneck, and the cheese pumpkins. Their shape is flattened like a wheel of cheese. Because of its resistance to squash bugs, and because I have found a very long-keeping variety selected over many years for that trait by Turtle Tree Seed, butternut is my main crop of winter squash. A gradually decreasing supply is stashed in my cool, dry, dark pantry closet, lasting at least until the following spring and even summer. Cucurbita maxima includes the plant kingdom's largest fruits. The contest winners, approaching half a ton, as well as many other outstanding eating varieties like Rouge Vif de Tampes and the Hokkaido pumpkin, kombucha, and Hubbard types. For beauty alone, though both are delicious, I love blue-skinned triamble and the dirigible called pink banana. The least grown species is C. argyrosperma, which tends to want a hotter summer than I can afford. But I have succeeded occasionally with one of its outstanding members, green-striped kusha. For best results, start with seeds of a regionally appropriate disease and pest-resistant variety whose days to harvest are within a reasonable span to match your season. Let me reread that statement because it sounded funny, but it's for best results, start with seeds of a regionally appropriate, and that's comma, and then disease and pest resistant variety, whose day to harvest are within a reasonable span to match your season. Like with all cucurbits, pumpkins and squash require heat, a steady system of supply of nutrients, and good garden sanitation to limit pests. In the spring of prevention, I am very particular about thorough fall cleanup to eliminate overwintering invitations for squash bugs in particular, removing all vine debris to a distance, hopefully giving me a good start the coming spring. Pre-warm the soil with black plastic sheeting for a week or more before the set-out date, which is just after final frost. An extra benefit to soil warming, weed-suppressing plastic, it limits nutrient leaching from rain. Many gardeners transplant cucurbits into slit cuts in the sheeting after a head start of 3 to 4 weeks indoors. I direct sow, staggering each half of my seedings about 2 weeks apart as extra insurance against insect pests, who seem to go for one age or the other of plants when they have a choice, leaving me the other. Covered transplants with lightweight row cover fabric for extra warmth, removing the wraps at flowering time to allow pollination. The covers may prevent squash bugs and vine borers from finding vulnerable young plants and laying their eggs. Rotating where cubites are planted may help outsmart pests, though rotation works better in a large-scale setting than small gardens. To create a high organic matter soil, I top dress before laying down plastic with compost and or organic fertilizer such as seaweed meal, and then I add a little into each planting hole. Provide regular, thorough watering throughout the root zone during the growing season without waterlogging. If you've looked at the root system of a spent cucurbit plant while pulling them at cleanup, they don't have a deep root system, meaning the moisture and nutrients in that top layer below the plastic are most critical. And our next topic is viburnums. It was the stately double-file viburnum with its outstretched arms covered in double rows of flat-topped white blossoms and the promise of red fruit and maroon fall foliage to follow that got me started with this outstanding genus of flowering and fruiting shrubs. The double file's growth habit is so distinctive, I could not help but notice it. I cannot imagine a garden, especially a garden with a focus on attracting birds or on creating a long season of visual interest, without a complement of viburnum. But lately growing them has posed some ethical and practical challenges. Sadly, in various eastern U.S. areas, this long popular Asian species has proven to be an ambitious self-sower, and some states have put it and some other non-native viburnums on the list of plants to be careful about, which may invade wild spaces. The European cranberry bush, the Opulus, is advised against in spots across the northern tier and in the mid-Atlantic region. I see V. delatatum with that warning attached. I have Viburnum dilatactum, Michael Dodge, with gold fall fruit and its pollinator, Cardinal Candy Red, and they don't seem to seed in at least not yet. Nor do some other Asian types like the highly fragrant V. carlesi, the Korean spice Viburnum, the Daphne-like fragrance from barely pink-flushed white flowers in late April. You can smell it across the yard, even when it's young, and by the time this rounded plant reaches maturity, you will smell it down the road. Viburnum Judy Judd's Viburnum, is also highly perfumed, as is V. Birkwoody. I have grown many other non-native, but these days, to avoid the possible non-native conflict, I focus on adding native ones only. And the choices here include Viburnum dentatum, that's called Arrowwood Viburnum, and Nannyberry, also Black Haw Viburnum, and Witherrod, and Maple Leaf Viburnum, but sometimes hard to find in the nursery trade. The European cranberry bush's native counterpart and native near look-alike is Viburnum trilobum, sometimes lately referred to as V. opulus var americana. The American cranberry bush Viburnum, another informal shrub with bright red fruit. Its presence led to my first encounter, not too so many years ago, with the Viburnum leaf beetle, itself an invasive pest from Europe that apparently particularly adores that species, and also V. opulus and certain others. Cornell keeps a helpful online list of species ranked by their susceptibility to VLB, from highly susceptible to most resistant. One spring day, I noticed a gray catbird intent on what looked like a dead shrub, but was a defoliated but alive American cranberry bush. The catbird was gorging on larvae, which turned out, once I did my homework, to be the Viburnum leaf beetle. They, in turn, had just finished eating the shrub's foliage. The food chain at work, until I interrupted it, squashed hundreds, and cut off the worst branches to bag tightly as trash. Now I use these most susceptible species in out-of-the-way spots as a kind of beetle trap crop to hopefully entice them away from the other shrubs, and between October and the start of April, I check young twigs for little bumps that are overwintering egg cases and prune and dispose of them. Viburnum nudum, whose fruit goes from pink through blue to almost black against waxy or even shiny leaves, gets devoured by the beetle, which doesn't seem to have an appetite for the V. dilatatum types, and leaves Michael Dodge alone. I am therefore weighing various factors. Whichever you choose, know this. Viburnums are not in general self-fertile, and for the heaviest fruit set, they like the company of another close but not genetically identical relative, a plant in the same species whose bloom coincides with its own, but is not the same cultivar. Do your research and mix up the plantings, not just all winter thur, if you are growing V. nudum, for instance. With pruning, less is more. Usually, viburnums need relatively little, assuming you planted the right species and cultivar in the right size space. Even the lightest pruning, like deadheading, isn't needed, since what you want is fruit after the flowers, unlike deadheading lilacs, to prevent messiness. If a little fine-tuning or gentle reshaping is required, I time my cuts right after bloom. Cut stems back judiciously to just above a node so the plant makes new shoots in a somewhat natural-looking style. Do not disfigure viburnums by topping or shearing branches halfway. And our next topic is not your average morning glories. Hummingbirds, butterflies, and even the Royal Horticultural Society, by bestowing its award of garden merit, agree. The annual vine called Ipomoea lobata, formerly Mina lobata, a.k.a. Spanish flag or exotic love vine, is the bee's knees. And those pollinators agree, come to think of it. Fusing flags with the exotic erotic, what about calling this July through frost morning glory relative the fan dance vine instead? That's what the flowers, which are born in clusters called aracemens, look like. A string of little fans or pennants dancing in the breeze. The tubular blooms start out red, but fade gradually so that each raceme includes some red, yellow, and white individuals. I'm happy to accommodate the Northeast's only breeding hummingbird species, the ruby-throated, so I also always make room for plants it likes to visit, including the hybrid cardinal climber or one of its parents, the cypress vine. The cardinal climber is a cross between Ipomoea quamauclet, the cypress vine native to Mexico and tropical America, which Thomas Jefferson grew. And I endeavored to grow Quamauset for its truly star-shaped flowers, and the cardinal climbers are more pentagon-shaped and finer textured foliage. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138.